Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program focuses on Artesia, New Mexico. What is Artesia? It's a small desert town way out in the middle of nowhere where the Obama administration is holding about 700 to 800 Central American women and children who are trying to immigrate to this country from South America. I understand it has been closed, so this topic is a little past its expiration date, but not really, because the fundamental questions about immigration are still in force. We're going to hear lots of information about that subject today. We'll have a panel discussion, essentially, hosted by Angela Ferguson about Artesia, about immigration. And we'll follow our usual format. We will break in about a half hour for some messages, and then we'll jump into the questions from the audience segment. This program was recorded on Sunday, November the 23rd of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And let us go now to the introduction.
Good morning, everyone. And I think it's notable, of course, this week and with the topic next week, that we're kind of in the law and order mode, where our producers seem to have figured out how to rip topics straight from the headlines. This week, of course, we had a major event with respect to immigration and immigration reform, and we're all waiting for the grand jury in St. Louis County to deliver its results with respect to the shooting in Ferguson. And so this week we have a presentation related to immigration, and we'll hear about some specific stuff and also some thoughts about the effect of this past week's events with President Obama. And next week we will have a representative of the Kansas City Public or the Police Department who will be speaking on the subject of Ferguson and civil order and relationships between the police and protesters and such. So I think that despite the holiday in the middle of all this, it's going to be an interesting time. And without further ado, then, I guess I will turn it over to our representatives who are going to talk to us on the specific subject of Expose and Close, Outrage and Artesia.
And I think you guys all know me. I'm Angela Ferguson. I'm a member here. And, you know, the government announced last week or about 10 days ago that they're closing Artesia. So I guess we're done and we could go home. Okay.
Unfortunately, that is not the case, because the battle continues.
Oh man, haven't you guys heard enough about immigration today? I mean, this week, aren't you sick of it? That's all that's on the news anymore. I guess we'll talk about it a little bit. Okay. Where is Artesia? Anyone out there know? Yeah, way out there.
Has anybody been there? Besides us?
Is it near Carlsbad?
It's 2 hours north of Carlsbad, 1 hour south of Roswell. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's this horrid stench of the cattle, of all of the cattle there in the stockyards, that sometimes this breeze comes over Artesia and you walk outside and it's just overpowering. So
I thought that was the bathrooms.
It's the FEMA bathrooms in the detention center.
Yeah. Okay, so why did they pick Artesia to put these women and children?
Artesia contains a large federal law enforcement training center where the Border Patrol, which I'm going to refer to as CBP for short, it's after 9/11, they took the individuals who inspect cattle, they started allowing them to inspect people. Not much training, but they switched over the agency's responsibilities. So they have a training center in Artesia, which is in the middle of nowhere. And the federal government decided to open that detention center, open the center to detain women and children that were crossing the border at the height. I believe they opened it at the beginning of July 2014.
And why did you go?
Of course, I'm sure that everyone heard on the news about the rush of women and children and the unaccompanied minor children from Central America, predominantly El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, that were coming across the border. They were invading our borders, which was not the case, but that's how the media portrayed it. So We got the call that a bunch of attorneys needed to go down there to help these women because they were being deported without given a right to present their cases for asylum. So we went.
You guys, I was scheduled to go to the Gamaliel week-long training. Lon Swearingen back there has been bugging me to go to week-long training. They have leadership training, and so I finally committed to take the time off from work. Had this week, I had nothing else scheduled to do, and then they put out this call for legal help in Artesia. I'd rather go do law work than leadership training. So I just wanted to see what they were doing. They put out the call. They asked for volunteers who spoke Spanish. Well, any of you who know me know that my Spanish is pitiful. So I didn't really think I'd be doing legal work down there because I don't speak Spanish, and I just wanted to go see. And I said on Facebook or somewhere, I think we should go. I think I'll go. And she said, yes, I'm in. And then she started raising money, and within a week she raised enough money to take five of us to Artesia and haul a trailer full of donations, and it was just kind of fun. Now, Mickey's a local immigration attorney, and this month, this week, this year of my life, I'm thankful for knowing Mickey. Her work was amazing down there.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And for her energy, because let me tell you, I've never had a harder week than the week we spent in Artesia. It was torture. I think we came back with a little PTSD ourselves, and we'll get into why, but it was a pretty awful situation. When we got there, could you kind of describe what it was like?
Yeah, because it's on a federal law enforcement training facility, the Fleet Center, as they refer to it, the security is pretty high on base. I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere, but there's security guards everywhere. When we pull up into Artesia, we have a trailer full of donations from local organizations here in Kansas City, like diapers, toys, everything. And we tried to take it to the detention center, and they said, no. We can't accept any of these donations. Shampoo, food, bottles, kids, books, crayons, toys, nothing. And we couldn't send any of it, but we have this huge trailer full of supplies, and what do we do with it? Federal law enforcement facility, they wouldn't allow us to donate anything, and that was ICE's decision. These women had, we walk in, and the women are all in these FEMA trailers, and I believe they put about, was it 40 people to a trailer? I mean, they really are. I mean, they're fabricated houses, fabricated facilities, and they're just planted on the detention center. There's a bathroom for all the women that is horrible, inhumane conditions, sewage blocking up. They make the little kids clean the toilets by bribing them to actually get food.
Oh, wait, only,
sorry,
if they want, only if they want their minutes on the telephone to talk to family members. Okay, so it wasn't always that they had to clean the toilets.
No. I guess I should go back. The women that were coming at the border were coming to the border and turning themselves into immigration authorities. They were not running from CBP authorities. The coyotes would bring them to the border and tell them they would pay for the rafts to cross the Rio Grande, which is near Matamoros. So it's right at the southern tip of Mexico because the smuggling route is owned by the cartels. So they're not coming in Arizona. They're not coming in California. They're coming in at the very southern tip of Texas. That's, if you even look at the maps, they're all coming in right there. So when they come in, the coyote will say, cross the river and climb up that hill, and immigration will come and get you. You know, they're not running from law enforcement authorities. They're not sneaking across the border. They're coming to turn themselves in. Most of these women had 2 to 3 minor children. Average age of children in detention, how old were they?
It ranged from
3
nursing babies to 18-year-olds. So it was all across the board. I don't know what the average was.
Yeah, so they cross the border. You know, they go up this hill, and then there's Border Patrol just waiting for them. And they walk up, and they say, I would like asylum. I am afraid to return to my country. So they load them up in buses, and they take them to the Gilera. Does anybody
hear? Wait. These Border Patrol agents, that's not what they asked them. They said, ma'am, why'd you come here?
I'm scared to go to my country?
No, they would always write down on the forms, the officer would write down, they came here for a better life. They planned to work for 3 years and go back home. And that's what we saw on form after form after form, the arrest form for these women at the border.
And it was a fabricated statement. These women did not say that. The government is trying to build cases to show that these women were not victims of torture or persecution. They're writing that so they'll be easily deported in front of an immigration judge. So the Obama administration and CBP from the very beginning started tainting these women's cases upon crossing the border. So when they cross the border, they go to what's called the Hilera, which is the ice box. It was a cattle meat processing plant that housed, you know, dead meat. And they put the children and the women in these hileras called the ice box, and you'll hear stories from immigrants. It's all over the internet if you look at it. They housed them there without any blankets, without a change of clothes.
They had those silver blankets. Have you guys ever seen those emergency silver blankets? They each were issued one of those, so they were okay.
In an ice box. I mean, it's a freezer.
It was only 60 degrees. Now, anyone out there know why they keep prisons so cold? Well, I was educated by the ICE officer who was in charge of our particular law library where we got to see our agents, or our clients. This officer said he was an environmental engineer in his private life before he became an ICE officer, and he said it kills germs if you keep it at 60 degrees. So it wasn't really ice. It wasn't really, you know, freezing temperature, but 60 degrees for kids who are poorly dressed. It was awful.
And they were in their clothes that they had crossed all of Mexico in. I mean, they didn't have a change of clothes. And they weren't allowed our donation clothes, so these women were really sitting in the same clothes for 3 to 4 days. No blankets. They would take their white washcloths that they would use to go bathe, and they would cover their hands with them because they didn't have blankets. And so when we talked to these women, they were covering themselves with my tiny washcloths because...
And their towels. They'd bring their bath towels into the law library and cover up with their towels or have them around their shoulders so they could get a little bit of warmth. And in the middle of the day, the officers would come in and gather up all the towels and washcloths, say, you can't have these in here. I guess they needed to do laundry, but, you know, they took away their blankies. Mm. So... what kinds of cases were you seeing in Artesia with these women? What was your typical day like, and what stories were you hearing?
The volunteer attorneys were part of a special association of attorneys called AILA, which is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, that made the call for volunteers to go down there. We'd show up, and we'd have to go through security. At 6 a.m., we would meet where we were meeting at, and we'd have to ask for a federal ID, go through security every morning. And then they would load us up into a van. We couldn't bring our phones, so we couldn't call.
Why couldn't we bring our phones?
Because they didn't want us taking pictures of the horrible facilities, and they knew it would get out to the public.
The week before we arrived, our AILA president, past president, she's a firecracker, man. She was crazy. But anyway, she was down there. And she had her phone. They didn't have the stupid rule yet, so she took some video of the children and how they were being treated by the guards and posted it on YouTube, got it out there on the internet, what the conditions were. And immediately we lost all access or ability to take phones in. No laptops. All of us had to carry in our laptops, but we had to get rid of the cameras. We had to show them that we had duct tape over the cameras on our laptops or we would be in trouble and we might not get to leave that night. So they didn't want information about Artesia getting out to the public.
It was a really surreal environment. I've been in jails before representing people as an intern from the public defender, and I've visited jails here with my immigration clients, but I've never been in a large facility such as it is now, especially seeing women and children locked up. It's usually, not that it makes it any better, I'm usually seeing adult men. And this facility housed about 600 women and their small children in prison-like conditions, so...
So we had nice little tables like this. We're in one of the FEMA trailers in a room maybe the size of this stage. And we had, the week we were there, 18 attorneys. So each one of us fought for a spot at a table when we get there in the morning, staked our claim. But if any private attorneys who had been hired by any of these women's families, they got priority and they got to bump us because we were free attorneys. We were like, you know, public defenders, and they're not real attorneys, right? That's the way we were treated. So anyway, at your table the night before, our organization would put in a list of the women who had asked to see an attorney or who had court the next day or who had something they needed to apply for. And so the women would come in. Well, I told you I didn't speak Spanish, so I had to take two interpreters with me. I had a law student who, you know, we weren't sure if they were going to come and speak this morning. I'm guessing she's getting ready for finals today. But a law student and a DACA student, they both went with us, and they acted as my interpreter. So I had to have help, assistance. But so you'd sit down, and your first client would come in. Well, each client would have one, two, or three. I never saw a woman with more than three kids, but I didn't have a first aid kit. What were these families like when you'd see them?
These women had... We got there in August. They had already been in there for a month and were being deported daily without their rights being recognized.
They'd been no deportations for 2 weeks when we got there.
Oh, because there was an outbreak of chickenpox, and you can't deport anyone back to their home country when there is some kind of a disease running through the detention center. So the chickenpox outbreak, thank God, it actually stopped the deportations while we were there. So we got a little chance to go in there and slow down the deportation machine.
But the night we got there, Sunday, was the 21st day, and so on Monday they were starting deportations again. So Sunday night, after we'd worked all day, Sunday night, our mentor said, okay, we got to have emergency stays, get these women off the plane. And we had five women we had to keep from getting on the plane at midnight when the next day started. So that was our first induction into actually filing something at Artesia.
It was like 4 hours after we got there. And we're filing emergency stays with the Department of Homeland Security for these women that we've never met. I mean, we hadn't met these women. They just handed us paperwork and said, these women are going to be deported tonight. Write up a motion. Let's see if we can stop this. It's going to be a last-minute thing.
Does anyone out there have any experience with asylum?
Anybody here with refugee law or worked with refugees? Let's give like just a basic rundown. There was one thing that Angela mentioned about clients. When you get to these detention centers, it's not like you have a list of like when you go to the Wyandotte County Sheriff website here in Kansas City, in KCK, on the website, you can look up to see who's in their facility. In this federal detention center, we had no clue who was there, how many women were being held. The government would not give us any lists of people. So how our project got started was there was a lawyer down there, and they would meet with one woman because they'd get a call from their relative. And so we didn't even know who we were going to represent down there. We just ran to the detention center and hoped that we would meet women that would want lawyers, because there's no lawyers for them down there.
Ambulance chaser.
We ran down there, and there's no way to know who's there. So you can only meet with a client if they ask to see you or if I put them on a list. So all these women are in these big FEMA trailers, and they're afraid to go to ICE and say, I'd like to see the free attorneys, because they weren't allowed to. They wouldn't allow them to come in our trailer, even though we were sitting there waiting for them to help them. ICE would not allow them unless they were on a list. But we don't have a list. How can we put these women on the list to see them? And we're literally like 200 feet apart from these women, but they can't come and see us because the government would not allow them. So what would happen is the first woman would come in, and she'd write a name down and put it in a little piece of paper. And she'd come in, and she would be talking to the attorney because somehow she got on our list of represented women. And first there were only like five women that were on the list out of 600. And they would take their list of paper, and after they'd get up from the chair talking to us in this big room, and ICE is all staring at us. They're all around us, all these guards in this FEMA trailer. They would sit down, and they would be like... And I was like, what the hell is that? I'm like, why are you dropping... I had no clue that they had set up a secret kite system. If you've ever seen any type of prison show, they would write the name of the woman that they were like bunking with in the same that would start the list that she wanted to be on the list to get in touch with an attorney before being deported. She had never had access to an attorney. She doesn't speak English. She doesn't know how to read and write. So the only way we had access to women who would ask for a lawyer is through a kite system. I mean, it was ridiculous.
And Mickey's picking up the trash and throwing it away.
For the first few hours, I was like, what are all these? I don't know what that is.
We didn't know. It's so, one of the things you learn in prison.
Yeah, we would get after the first day and we start this kite system, and more women would get on the list, and ICE would get angry. They're like, why do all these women need to see attorneys? They're fine.
Well, the week we were there, we established a new system, and ICE installed boxes so the women could drop requests to see attorneys in an actual box. They were afraid of that system, though, so the kite system kind of continued on for a while. Man, you know, I said I don't speak Spanish. Do you speak mom?
What's that?
Why, man, I don't know what that is. Or Lakatec or whatever.
Cobampal. And
wow, yeah, man, there's some weird dialects coming out of Guatemala, you know? You'll be sitting across from a woman trying to converse with her in Spanish through the interpreter, and she's nodding. She doesn't understand anything you're saying, or very little, because she speaks a strange dialect from Guatemala. When we arrived, so we've been throwing out a lot of names here. So the federal facility where they train people, we had those guards, and then we had ICE guards. That's the Immigration Customs Enforcement, and they transferred in guards from all over the United States to go down there and work for 2, 3, 6 weeks. And so they were all temporary guards on assignment. And then you had CBP guards, and then he had the asylum office. Now, the asylum office, they're supposed to be the folks offering protection. If you establish that you are fearful of going back to your home country because of persecution, because you fear the government or someone in the country that will persecute you because of your religious beliefs or your membership in a particular group, or your nationality, or your ethnicity, or your political opinions. It has to be real specific. So these asylum officers are there, and their goal was to do asylum interviews, credible fear interviews, to see if these women have any kind of credible fear so they can deny them and get them on the plane. Okay. The weeks before we arrived, they had just rammed them through. I mean, they had done these interviews as fast as they could. Then the chicken pox hit and the deportation stopped. They couldn't get them on the planes. And it gave our crew the opportunity to ask for redos, you know?
But we did these redos to shame them. I mean, you get an interview and you're reading the transcript because it's recorded, and they say, do you fear going back to your country? And the asylum officer's typing. They're not making eye contact with the women. They're not asking if they speak any other language besides Spanish. These women have their crying babies sitting on their laps. I mean, it's a horror. I mean, they're telling that they've been raped and abused and beaten by the gangs or beaten by government officials. In this environment where the officer's not paying attention to them, their kids are sitting right next to them. There's no woman that wants to talk about the rape of her daughter or her own rape or the violent sexual abuse that she suffered in front of her own kids. And they would do the officer would do the interview, and it, like 30 minutes, would meet, and then they would deny them. But they would make the notes when the women would explain the abuse that they were in. Like, they would say, these women, a lot of them would actually explain. And they were great asylum cases. Under any other place or facility, I would be like, oh my gosh, that's a great case for asylum. Clearly under the law, under U.S. asylum law, they have asylum. But these officers would write what they would say, and then they would deny them, thinking that no one's going to read this interview. And they would just deny them. So when the chickenpox outbreak happened, they would deny these, and all these women would come to us, say, they denied us. Why are they denying us? And we'd read their transcript, and I would just be appalled. I'd be like, oh my gosh, you're a victim of rape and you clearly stated that, and they're saying you don't have any fear to return. So we would jump in and try to shame these officers into giving us a new interview, because here are all these hordes of immigration lawyers coming down there. Well, 18 of us. And all of a sudden we were shaming them, and we were going to go to the media about, and we did, about how the government was systematically denying these women.
Well, we got redos, and a real credible fear interview would take 3 or 4 hours, and you'd need to prepare your client and try to find a way to get the children out of the vicinity. And almost every single one that we redid, they reversed their decision. They found credible fear. And then once they found that there was fear for this person to go back, then they had to see an immigration judge. The week we were there, they had three judges there seated in Falls Church, Virginia, at the headquarters of the Executive Office for Immigration Review, and they did hearings by televideo. So I can see your faces pretty good out there. Not too many smiles. I'm sorry we're depressing you out there. But, you know, we go into court into a room where there was a laptop sitting or a very small TV, and you'd be sitting with your client and her children on her lap, and you'd be looking at the screen of the court in Falls Church, Virginia. Now, the judge's screen, we heard from people that went into court on the other end, had a kind of a black bar across the bottom so that the children's view was blocked off. They didn't really want to see what was going on. They didn't want to see the connection between the mother and the children. But the video was so bad. We finished one hearing and the client said, "Where was the judge? You know, the head was so tiny. You're sitting there talking to a talking head 6 feet away."
In a FEMA trailer. You're in a FEMA trailer and you don't know the guards don't speak Spanish, most of them. The guards grab your woman and they go to a trailer and she screams, "I need my lawyer." And then we run around, they try to find us, and we all get, and all of a sudden there's a laptop, probably like from where that gentleman's sitting, and right here.
It was a very fair
system. It's a joke. And there's a little man sitting there saying,
Your bond is $30,000. You passed your credible fear interview, but the bonds that week we were there were being set at $25,000 and $30,000. Now, the week before, we were getting a bond amount set. The week before, there was no bonds. Our government made the decision and told the judges that no one will be leaving Artesia except to go back to their home countries, period. So the first Monday, we got $30,000 and $25,000 bonds. Well, these women have just paid to transport their kids and themselves to the border. They've paid. They don't have $10,000 or $12,000 to pay these coyotes to bring them. You know, they've borrowed the money, or they have promised to become indentured servants here in the United States to pay off their debt. Okay? So they already are majorly in the hole, and here the bonds are being set at $25,000 or $30,000. By the end of the week, with positive credible fear interviews and evidence that we were able to get together and momentum, we cracked one of the judges, and she started setting them at $6,000. And the average bond across the United States for detainees here in Kansas City, everywhere across the United States, the average bond is $5,200. $5,200. But here these women and children are being set at $25,000 and $30,000, or no bonds at all. So it was a success. And these new bond hearings started being set at $6,000, $5,000 by the end of the week. And then the split between the three judges in Falls Church kind of escalated, I think. And some of the other judges, the other two, started being a little more reasonable, and then all of a sudden Falls Church is cut off. This is after we're back home, and those three judges were removed, and the cases were transferred to Denver. So we have a whole new crew of judges hearing the Artesia cases.
And the speculation is that we shamed those judges that they were honestly saying on record that this young 26-year-old woman with her two kids under the age of two are a national security threat. That was what the government was telling these women to their faces, that you're an asylum seeker, but we believe that you are a threat to national security. And that is why I'm justifying that you can have a bond for $30,000. They said that these women and children were national security threats and terrorist threats. This is when we heard that ISIS was crossing the border during that ridiculous argument in August and September. So these judges in Falls Church, Virginia, they're at ICE headquarters. So they're usually, you know, run-of-the-mill government attorneys. They really don't listen to reason, and they deny these bonds. And so we had random volunteers across the country fly into D.C. and sit, like, while we're here on the little laptop having the hearing, they would go in and stare these judges down. Well, just like legal observers to witness the horror.
Professors and bloggers and people that were getting the story out.
The Washington Post, the LA Times, the New York Times, the Miami Herald, all started showing up and pretty much shaming the Obama. I'm sorry, I keep on dissing on him right now. I'm happy with him now. But
I was going to wear my Obama t-shirt today because, you know, I'm kind of happy with him this week. But that week I wasn't so happy.
And I'm still not.
Yeah. Okay. We'll get to that. Okay, we'll get there. It's being closed. Why is it being closed, and what are they going to do?
So the detention center that we were at that was a deportation mill was finally shamed out of existence. It was shamed out of existence because of all of us went down there and we're winning all these cases of asylum for these women in front of judges. We're winning. And Obama said that the Obama administration said that none of these women had valid asylum claims, that they're just coming here because they're criminals or because they want to work, and that is not true. The vast majority of these women have asylum. We shut down the Artesia Center, but on Thursday night, when Obama announced his decision at 7 p.m. Central Time, buses ran to Artesia, picked up these women that are represented by attorneys down there and transported them to Carnes Family Detention Center. They moved them away from their attorneys under the clout of Obama's administrative action, you know, pretty much in the night, like a thief. Took these women and children and transported them to a center where they would not have contact with their attorneys. He's still moving forward with family detention. Artesia, the center that we were at that housed 600 people, they're building a mega baby jail, and this jail is going to be located in Dilley, Texas. I've never been to Texas in my life, but in Dilley, Texas, they're building a facility for women and children that is going to house about 2,400. So this doesn't end the nightmare of family detention.
Okay, test question for you guys out there: Who is going to operate the jail in Dilley, Texas?
CCA.
Yes,
CCA. Build it and they will come.
Taxpayer money per bed, per detainee. The longer the women stay there, the more money these private jails make.
Okay. So our kind of idea about the Obama administration's wonderful announcement this past week on immigration is that he's going big. He's promised this since before he was first elected. To have some immigration reform, and he just didn't get it through Congress. But he's using these women and children as examples, as the sacrificial lambs, to say he's tough on enforcement, and they're going to continue fighting. Now, you know, I really do believe in due process, and there is nothing that our government is doing for these women that even has any hint of due process. They did everything possible they could to hinder us from representing, appearing in court. You know, when they would come in during the day and we're sitting there with our clients at 18 tables and we're full and everyone's doing consultations, and they come in and they say, "You can't have this many people in here. This is too crowded." And they took away our chairs. Well, or they'd come in and they'd take away our clients. They can't wait this long. Or there was a waiting room for clients to come in to see us, and they would just randomly take them away.
Take away my clients' pens and crayons in which they filled out their asylum application.
Here we go. That's what we have here, just so you have an idea of what life was like for them. These kids, they were there for months. There was no school. And the crayons. What happened with the crayons in Artesia?
The women were treated as prisoners, and so any of the children, women and children, were not allowed to have pens or crayons. When the judge handed them an 11-page asylum form and told them to have it for their next hearing in a week, fill out this form, they weren't given pens. The forms are in English. They don't speak English. We would sneak them pens and crayons, and we were not allowed to, but I didn't care. We didn't care. I would sneak in. I would, like, go to CVS down there, and I would buy all these, like, cheap Bic pens and hand them out. Like, fill out yours. I didn't care. They need to fill out these forms, and the government would not allow them. And crayons, we gave too many out, and the kids started drawing on the wall in these detention centers.
The oldest form of protest.
Yeah.
Perhaps this would be a good time to shift over to the question mode.
You're listening to a panel discussion on today's All Souls Forum about immigration, and specifically Artesia, New Mexico, hosted by Angela Ferguson. It's now our usual break time. We owe you a couple messages. We'll do those, and we'll come right back with questions from the audience. This is the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Hey, I'm Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots. Each week, we bring you music and artist interviews from across the American soundscape. Blues and jazz, old-time country and gospel, roots rock and soul, Zydeco, Tejano, and beyond. Join me on the journey on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9:30, right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
On October 24, 2014, 15-year-old Native American freshman student Jalen Freiberg shot five other students at Marysville Pilchuck High School in the state of Washington. He fatally wounded four before fatally shooting himself. On the next Sprouts, Radio Curious interviews Jerome Edge, a DJ and Native American hip-hop activist, about the high school shooting. Tune in Thursday at noon.
There's no shortage of outside experts and billionaires who want to fix public education in Missouri, usually by blaming teachers. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, teachers talk about how they defeated Amendment 3, what's wrong with too much testing, and perhaps even what happened to Ferguson and surrounding towns when the state took over the schools. That's Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
This week on The Bioneers.
We are about to leave our children with a mess. What we can do now is make an investment so that our children will at least have a chance to turn this mess around.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week it's Generation Green, fulfilling the promise of jobs and justice on The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics.
This week on Music City Roots, live from the factory, we count our blessings and revel in friendship as we usher in the holidays with two of the most powerful and spiritual voices in Music City. Mike Ferris focuses his fire in a spare set with acoustic guitar and his pal Paul Brown on organ. And we close the show with the mighty Newgrass and blue-eyed soul of John Cowan.
In a Joshua tree.
Also on this show from the eve of Thanksgiving, laid-back and honest songs from Todd Grebe and Cold Country, plus a stunning display of acoustic guitar as bluegrass masters Richard Bennett and Wyatt Rice open the night. All that plus Jim Lauderdale on Music City Roots.
Saturday morning at 7, right before the Blues Kitchen.
A little spare time? Always wanted to be in radio? Well, then come on down and get involved in your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KKFI. On the air or behind the scenes, we need your help, and it's lots of fun, too. For more information, call Bill at the KKFI offices at 816-994-7869.
I have always wondered what should have been done, what could have been done, you know, because I would imagine in my mind it would have been so ideal if everybody had been placed into a private home and that homeowner was accountable for their whereabouts. But that's not like, I mean, that's just not possible. But just in your view, what could have been done, what should have been done with this great influx?
No, that's a great question. I even get that question from my mom. I sincerely believe that so the unaccompanied children, that's something different. When the children ran across the border and they have no parents, they're placed in the Department of Health and Senior Services, and then they're placed in a foster care home and reunited with a family member here. In our cases, they were adults, so it was an adult woman with her child. A lot of these women, I would say 95% of these women and children had a relative here, whether they were living like an aunt, an uncle, a cousin, a mother. Somebody was living here, whether documented.
Daddy.
Yeah, the baby's father was here. And giving those bonds and making them go to court to legally process their asylum claim would have been much better than detaining them, because the long-term effects on children that were placed in detention is pretty horrible. So,
you know, but there is no process. I have families who've come out of the woodworks to say, you know, I'll take three children. I'm willing to take one or two. And occasionally we can match someone up and go through and do the guardianship process or something. But there is no process for it set up by our government. It's a good idea. It's not happening.
Angela and I actually went down there and we said the reason why we brought a big car is because we knew we were going to bring kids home. I mean,
that didn't happen either.
No, there's no process, and it takes months to get legal guardianship. So I wish there was a process to put a lot of these women and children, because they're not going to stop coming until the conditions get better in those countries. They're going to keep coming to the border asking for asylum. So I wish we could have a better process and where they should be placed. But obviously bond is better.
Is your organization, AILA, filing suit against the government for various constitutional violations?
Oh, yes. So the week we were there, it was so much fun. The week we were there, the ACLU and then what was the other organization? I can't remember. AIC, the American Immigration Council. They sent lawyers down there, and so we met with them on Sunday night, and on Monday, they just were incorporated into our group, and they took up some of the space in the law library.
They snuck in with us.
And when Mickey would interview a lovely woman and hear a particularly horrible story about how she was mistreated by the guard or not fed or child was really sick and not getting the medical treatment that was needed there in the prison, then she would just kind of shift that client over to the ACLU attorneys who would spend time taking statements. And the week after we left, Artesia, the ACLU, filed a lawsuit against the government, and that's ongoing, and I'm sure had something to do with why the facility was shut down.
Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Two questions. One, this didn't get much publicity, but last week or the week before, the Obama administration announced that they're going to start taking applications for asylum in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. But you have to stay there pending, you know, hopefully you don't get killed in the meantime. But anyway, can you comment on that and how significant that is? And then my second question is, are you going to be going back down to this new facility in Dilley when it opens, or are you going to go to Carnes, or and what can people here do?
Good questions. Okay, so the United States accepts a certain number of refugees into the United States every year, but Central America just simply was not allotted any of those numbers. You know, we typically would take Eastern Bloc countries over situations, I think Judy spoke a couple of weeks ago, situations that we created in Central America. So we don't allow refugees to come in. Refugees and asylees, a refugee is someone who applies for protection while they're still in their home country, applies to the United States, and asylees make it to U.S. soil and ask for protection. So the Obama administration said 4,000 visas, refugee numbers would be set aside for Central American Central Americans who apply while they're still in their home countries. We don't know if that's started, what kind of information is getting out to the communities there, if people know that they can get to the U.S. Embassy, if getting to the U.S. Embassy and asking for that help actually targets them more while they're there in their country. We're not sure how that one's working.
How are they even going to get on the facility? Like, it's like a joke. I'm sorry. When you go to the U.S. Embassy in Honduras, for example, they do not let you in the doors. They don't let you through the gates. You walk up, and the guard, the security, you start noticing people with uniforms around, with their Uzis out as well. I mean, it's Honduras is one of the most dangerous countries in the world, but you can't just go there without an appointment, without a passport, without putting your... I mean, you can't just walk up there and say, I'd like to apply for refugee status. I mean, you can't get on the facility to ask. So the Obama program announcing these visas was just a... It was just a political ploy to act like he was doing something to stop the flow of people coming. You could have never, all the people that are running across the border that are here now are not eligible for those refugee visas. There's 8,000 people running to the border every month, and there's only 4,000 refugee visas available per year. I mean, it's a much bigger problem.
I'd like to ask a question. I'm looking for a kind of a step back reflection here in terms of not the firsthand experience, but the sort of secondhand. How do we make sense? How do all of us in this room make sense? And let me prime the pump a little bit. You've made frequent reference to the Obama administration. I think we all understand that there's an enormous amount of executive, legislative, and just the hidebound nature of the Homeland Security, the way it came together. So I have two questions that are kind of, I think, are related. One is, to what extent is social media being used by traditional advocacy groups to really get more intimate, timely pictures out, and if not pictures, text, whatever works? And the second really is, are we framing this in a way that we're going to have leverage in the future if we keep referring to the Obama administration did this or the president did that? Isn't there a broader conceptualization of we are doing that? I think Judy was pretty emphatic about that a couple of weeks ago. So from the standpoint of not just the firsthand work, but the legal profession, your association, are you broadening the conversation in a way that I think we all will recognize?
Oh, let's hope so. We have worked hard to try to get the story out. Each day from Artesia, the attorneys that were down there would do video interviews about what they saw that day. And those videos are playing all across the nation. When they took away phone access and picture access, then, you know, they kind of forgot. Well, we still had internet access, and so some of the lawyers would carry their laptops into the hearings and tweet live and get step-by-step out about what was going on in the hearings. Every single asylum trial that has taken place for the women at Artesia that are represented by AILA, they've won. We've been successful. Let me tell you that here locally, I'd say the average win rate for asylum would be maybe 10-15%. Okay? Every single one of the cases down there is winning. These are not fake cases that are coming in. The week we were there, Ferguson, Missouri exploded. That's all that was on the media. There was nothing about Artesia getting out. And I don't know if with the Ferguson decision coming down again next week that maybe that'll take some of the heat off of the Obama administration on his immigration decisions. Maybe the news will shift.
I found social media to be incredible in getting our word out, though. I mean, Angelo is completely right. Ferguson came and clouded it, but our videos, if you Google Artesia and my name or Angela's name, our videos were shown in the White House. We got word back from our national lobbyists that they were watching our videos every day. They did an investigation of Artesia and found no problems, but social media did reach the White House, and they did hear our complaints. If you Google, a lot of our names were quoted in some of the newspapers. Like, I never interviewed with any of these reporters. They just did it from our videos and put it up there. So I think social media helped a lot. I really do.
But at the same time, the government's putting out crap. I mean, they're lying to people. I was looking for a stuffed animal to put up here. The week we were there, the government posted beautiful videos of the dorm rooms that these women and children are staying in with teddy bears on their pillows. And
crayons.
Just showing how beautiful the place is. And, you know, it's just misinformation. And that's what they're putting out there. It just breaks your heart when you would see
it's a battle.
See the lives that are being just harmed.
On his second question about putting this all into context, and it's Sunday morning and I'm watching George Stephanopoulos. I'm taping it right now. And I do speak very strongly against the Obama administration. I used to work for the Democratic Party before I went to law school. I've always been, unfortunately, sometimes a blind member of the Democratic Party, but since I became an immigration lawyer, my party affiliations have pretty much gone out the roof. I mean, I don't know what I am anymore. But I do believe that Judy stating that it's us that are doing these actions really, it changed the attitude in my family. I've got 10 aunts and uncles, and when I use the word we instead of the Obama administration, it really makes them, I think, reflect more on what's going on. I don't know if they actually, it moves them to action, but I think it makes them feel something. I mean, I think we should use we more, and I'm sorry for being so negative towards the Obama administration sometimes, but...
Okay, really quickly, though, this week he did some really good stuff that's going to help a lot of people,
millions, a lot
of our clients. I started doing immigration work back in 88, back when the Reagan amnesty was passed, and that granted status to 4 million people, and this could be bigger, and it's really focused on the parents who have U.S. citizen children and permanent resident children. So it could help a lot. It's not enough. We need real status instead of temporary status, but it is progress. So there's.
I have a quick question. What happened to the supplies that you took? And after you answer that, maybe you can go ahead and tell us more about your interpretation of what's happening with Obama's announcement this last week.
Yeah, all the supplies. So Angela went directly to the detention center, but I have this big-ass car, a Navigator, with a trailer on it. I am not a good driver. I'm like, I need to get rid of these supplies. So I got in the phone book, and I found a Spanish-speaking Catholic church that was two blocks away from the detention center, and they took them all. A father, you know, we went into the church after Mass, grabbed the father from the pulpit, and said, we have all these donations, can we leave them with you? And they took them all, and they eventually got permission to take the supplies in a month later. So the supplies were taken, and it was that was the first, like, punch in the face when you get down there. So,
can I just make a correction?
Yeah.
I didn't say we're all responsible.
Oh, sorry.
You know, what I said
I
was...
I apologize.
You know, sorry,
actually, it was me that said that now that I think about
right.
it.
So I'm going to disagree. There are very clear interests who are responsible, and they're not us. And they're, you know, there's this immigration industrial complex, which is benefiting tremendously. You mentioned Corrections Corporation of America. That's one of them. But I think we all are responsible in the sense that we all can do something about it. But I just wanted to make that clear.
Thanks, Judy.
One of the things you can do about it, More Squared, this congregation is a member of More Squared. All of you who are members here are members of More Squared. We have an issues night once a month. The first Monday in December is the next issues night. And we have an immigration team that's working on things, and Artesia was one of them. I'm not sure what the next one is. Come out on December the 1st. It will be at Redemptorist Catholic Church at 6 o'clock, and we'd love to have some more input from the All Souls team. Yes?
Question about the recent announcement by Obama. The details I know are a little fuzzy in my mind, and I guess in a lot of people's mind, but the gist of it I understand is that people who might be eligible will get a 2-year deferral from deportation. 3-year, okay. Why would anybody in that status sign up for this and basically identify who they are, where they live, where they work, where their families are,
right,
and then at the end of that 2 or 3 year period, who knows what's going to happen? Aren't they essentially turning themselves in for a future deportation?
That is a great question. I actually had that question this morning at breakfast. One, the state of mind of the individual who this benefits is they're so desperate because they've been here for more than 10 years, no criminal, and they're so afraid for their children who are U.S. citizens of them not coming home one day for work and their kids never see them again. That's why they're applying. There is fear out there that after 3 years, the reason why we like 3 years instead of two is because the government's going to charge these immigrants $465. I mean, immigration is a fee-based system. It's no taxpayer money. For USCIS to apply for these work cards. The immigrants are paying for their benefit and at no taxpayer expense. It's $465, and so if the work cards are good for 3, they only have to pay it once every 3 years instead of 2 years, and that's what we pushed for in this reform aspect. The work cards are going to be brilliant. These people are going to apply for a work card. They are going to be giving them their employment. They are going to be giving evidence that they're here. But the chance of having a driver's license to give to a police officer every day when they get pulled over, the chance of having a social security number where they can actually go get a job that pays them more below minimum wage, that, you know, there's a lot of restaurants here within 1 mile radius that pays immigrants a horrible salary, and they've worked there for more than 10 years, and they do it because they know they can pay them less than these immigrants now will be allowed to go get a living wage. I am not that afraid that the government, and maybe Angela can comment, I don't have fear that the government will deport these people that came in, that are going to be registering them. Like, we get a new president, but Angela might have different.
Yeah. You know, and in the Reagan amnesty days, built into the law was protection for the applicants that said that we will not use this information to enforce against you if your application is denied. That protection isn't in this executive order. They very well could use the information. It is a leap of faith for someone to come forward. But I think people are so desperate and so ready for a little stability in their lives that many of them are willing to do it. I have DACA kids, the students who have been able to get legal. They'll come back to me with when they do their renewal, they'll stop by to just say thank you, and they say, you know, it changed my life to know that I every day when I leave the house that I can't be arrested. It's changed my life. It changes their perspective. It gives them hope to go on to college or to ask for a better job or whatever. So I think people will do it. I tell you, I don't know why we're here. We should be at our offices working.
Well, let's be sure now and say a great deal of thanks for all this information, and especially the efforts this past summer.
You've been listening to a panel hosted by Angela Ferguson talking about Artesia and current policies of the Obama administration on immigration. Hope you enjoyed this program. You can find it in podcast form next week on the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org. Just go to our podcast section and you can drill down and search for it and find all of this year's programs archived for you if you want to listen to them again or if you missed them and wanted to hear them. This program was recorded on November 23rd at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City. This program is produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help each week with this program. And the music you are hearing is composed and played by Fred Potter. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.